This episode of the CMO Suite is brought to you by Uconnex. Uconnex is the premier provider of managed and in-house servicing in the biddable media space. If you're looking for true transparency with paid social, PPC, or programmatic, or are a brand or agency looking into in-housing your team, connect with Uconnex today. Visit them at uconnex.com. And Tumi. Tumi provides luxury without limits. I've got the bag. I've got the backpack. If you're a business traveler, nothing lets you roll in style like Tumi. And finally, No Kid Hungry. We are incredibly proud to make a contribution to No Kid Hungry in the name of each of our 2019 guests. Stop by NoKidHungry.org today to contribute and help kids be kids, not be hungry.
You're in the CMO Suite, the podcast for marketers who want to be in the know, presented by Connectivity Holdings.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the CMO Suite. I have with me today Philip Sosinski. Philip, it is great to have you helping us to produce the show. And I'm super excited. We have with us, you know, I was here about a month ago and we did what we called Legends Week. And I feel like this week needs to be called Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Week because we've got a good friend of mine from Sony coming in a little bit later. We're going to start the week off with Dean Harris. Dean Harris is the co-founder and CMO of Tab Brands. Dean has an extensive background building brands and businesses. He has served as the head of marketing and chief marketing officer for Hot Jobs, Vonage, Kayak, KGB, and Blue Kava. Dean, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
So listen, I said we were going to start this or call this week something, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And we want to make sure that we find out about some other parts of your background. But Tab Brands is in the cannabis space. Am I correct?
It is. We we're a health and wellness brand company, but we are in the medical cannabis.
So I don't want to skip to the end of the story at the beginning of the story, but I wanted to at least set the reference tone as to why we might be calling it that. So that said, you've had really an incredible journey when you look back at some of the brands that you've worked with. Tell us a little bit maybe about how you kind of got your start in the business itself.
Sure. I'm actually third generation marketing advertising person. Yes, which is interesting because there probably only have been four generations possible.
That's true. I guess when you think about it.
It started in the late 1800s.
Let's see. I'm 49. My club age, Philip knows this, my club age is 37.
Right. My health age, my fitness age is 35.
That I love.
Yes.
I'm stealing that one from you.
That's what my trainer says.
Damn it, Dean. I'm going to take that one from you. So you called that your health age?
Yes.
You said your health age is 35.
Theoretically. Although my trainer said yesterday it's down to 34.
So I'm
older than 34.
You said four generations.
Well, I said there have been four generations of marketers. I'm third. So my grandfather started an agency in New York in 1922.
Wow.
In fact, I passed the building when I got out of the train this morning. It was at 400 Madison Avenue, back when ad agencies used to be on Madison Avenue.
Yeah.
And then my father ran a direct marketing agency. And then after school, my wife and I started an advertising agency.
Do you remember your grandfather?
Absolutely.
Much?
Sure.
Had you ever been to the agency
of
when
course.
He was there?
Of course. I used to go there and his secretaries would type my papers in high school.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, I do remember him very well. And interestingly, my grandfather's big claim to fame in the advertising world is he did the Timex campaign. So my grandfather my grandfather was "It takes the licking and keeps on ticking."
Really?
Yes, really. So
wow,
I didn't wear my Timex today, but I do have
I won't one. Tell him. I won't tell him. I'm sure he's probably watching up in heaven and he's probably being
I
like,
hope so.
Why in the world didn't you wear your Timex if you're going to tell a great story?
But anyway, so I was exposed to the marketing and advertising world from the time I was a zygote.
And so you almost didn't have a choice.
Well, I sort of did have a choice. I mean, I didn't really think I was going to do it. I thought I was going to become an academic. And then after one master's degree, decided that I really didn't want to teach anthropology at a university in North Dakota. So I went to business school.
So born and raised here in New York?
Yes.
And so, geez, your grandfather, that's so interesting to think of. Sometimes this industry feels so timeless, but no pun intended on the watch analogy there. But you're right, when you think about it, there's only really been up to four generations.
Yeah, it started in the late 1880s, NWR. That was really the first formal marketing.
I don't know that story.
Yeah. NWR is an agency that's no longer around, as most of them
but
aren't.
But it's considered one of really the precursors
The first. So anyway, I'm very happy to be part of the tradition. It's been an interesting career.
And so your dad was in the business as well.
Mm-hmm.
And also did he work for your grandfather?
No, he had his own. I also come from a long line of entrepreneurs. So my father had, in effect, a direct marketing agency. And my mother was an academic. So I guess that was my conflict.
And so if your dad was a direct marketer, talk to us again, the same thing. Do you feel like you learned a lot from him along the way because of the fact that what he did and what your grandfather did were so different, but he probably was a precursor in some ways to direct marketing?
Maybe. Maybe. I mean, I certainly the techniques have changed. The principles are very much the same. So, I've had a sort of both an informal and a very, very formal marketing and advertising background. And it's been interesting to try to apply it to new categories, as I'm doing now.
And so what you were able to do is, again, it sounds like you were able to learn parts and pieces that along the way. And then how did you personally get your intro into the business? Did you work for your dad?
No. No, I...
So every generation stayed in the business, but you decided to start your own thing.
No.
Is there something deeper to that?
I did work for two large New York advertising agencies when I got out of school. I worked for Gray and Lintas, and I worked on very formal, traditional stuff, Procter & Gamble and Johnson & Johnson. So I started my career in detergent, fabric softener, disposable diapers. That's about as formal as it gets. And then in my 20s, I met this woman at a wedding. We really hit it off. She was in advertising. I was in advertising. We started dating. We heard there was this account up for grabs. We pitched it and got it, and we were in business.
Wow.
So that was a while ago.
Both personally and professionally,
absolutely.
Huh? So you guys started an agency, you and your wife.
We did.
What did you guys specialize in?
Nothing, really. We specialized,
whatever you needed
to. Specialized in good, we hope. We tended to do sort of the smaller brands for large companies. So we had some pretty respectable accounts. I mean, we did Coke, Sotheby's, Citibank, J&J, Nestle's. But we tended to do the smaller brands. In large part, the big agencies didn't want to touch them, and they'd sort of throw the, you know, the lesser talent. That was our niche.
Isn't it funny? I won't ask you how long ago that was, but it's funny to think that still happens today. I mean,
it does.
We own an advertising agency, and it's one of the things that's within our ownership group, but it's the same. They get to work with Corona. They've worked with Pabst. They get to work with brands. You know, they may not work with either. Their specialty is that they do kind of a localized approach. So if it's a Coke, they're helping Coke in local markets as opposed to building, you know, brand development there. But that tradition maybe hasn't even changed that much. The big agencies only want to handle the biggest of the big.
And I think part of the tradition too is that it doesn't really take all that much to start an agency. You really don't need capital.
Well, that's for sure.
You need your brain and you need an account. So we need an account. So we had an account. We got more accounts. Our first account, you were going to ask me.
How was it? How did you know?
Yes, our first account was Chin on Cameras. Our second account was J&J.
I had a friend of mine, when I was first getting into entrepreneurship myself, it's funny, we're in iHeart Radio Studios. I want to, of course, thank iHeart for all of the hospitality that they give us. I used to work for iHeart. I was in radio sales for quite a few years. And then I myself got the entrepreneurial bug. I think I got it, Dean, because I had dealt with a lot of agencies. And at the time I was like, boy, if these guys can do this,
anybody can.
I mean, almost anybody can, right? To some extent. But a buddy of mine was telling me pretty early on when I was asking for some advice, he just said, in some cases, you fill a room with some smart people and then, you know, you go out and pitch. And I guess that's what you do.
Yeah. Well, it's fun. So another thing that's great about it, and this is probably even truer now than it was back when we started, is that you can have an idea, you can execute it, develop it, and very quickly see if it works.
So you had an agency. Do you still own that agency?
No.
So you had it, you built it up.
We built it, we ran it for a long time. And then in the late 90s, when the internet was exploding, we decided that one of us should be involved in the internet. So I was the designated driver. And I had heard there were these things called job boards. So I put together a digital resume and I went to this job board called Hot Jobs. And they had a job as head of marketing.
Let me pause you for just a second. Everything okay over there, Philip, on what you're shooting? Fantastic. We're shooting video for the show a little bit as well. It's an extra element for us. I mean, you know, you shoot radio, and then you have everybody asking for content. So we decided to add some video this year. We heard there's this thing called video,
right.
And you should add it into the content that you have. That's what we've been told. And so using that to kind of come back full circle with a frame of reference, you had heard there were these things called job boards.
I would have heard there was things called job boards. So I was going to be the designated driver. So I put together a digital resume. And I sent it to Hot Jobs on Tuesday. They had a job as head of marketing for Hot Jobs. So on Thursday, I was the head of marketing for Hot Jobs. So I went home and talked to my kids. My son, I think, was 13 or 14 at the time. And I said, hey, Zach, want to hear something great? I'm now the head of marketing for Hot Jobs. And he said, I'm going to clean this up. He said, what a joke. I know more about the internet than you do. So thank you for your support.
Gotta love kids.
He probably still knows more about the internet. He does know more about the internet than I do.
It is funny to see youth today with, I feel like some of the changes happening so incredibly fast. But what I've found fascinating, especially about a show like this or getting a chance to talk to marketers like you, Dean, is that even though some of these younger kids may know a lot more about what's happening in the social space or in the programmatic space or biddable or anything like that, you still need some historical. You still need everything new is also still old to some extent, and there's still plenty of opportunities for people who are still learning.
I agree. I mean, I think the principles are the principles.
Yeah.
And the way we execute, the tools we use are different, but a lot of the theories hold, and that's been fascinating. So when I started for these tech-centric internet companies, I had more traditional experience than most people, and I found that to be useful. Plus, I had the agency background, which taught me how to execute, and that is a lot of it.
How did you transition from there? It looks like, again, that you went to Kayak and Vonage and some other places.
Yeah, I mean, I had a reputation as being a seasoned CMO, and I had opportunities to go to a number of places. I liked going to places that were in industries that could be disrupted. I know that that's a common term.
But it's a buzzy word
now. It's a buzzy word,
but
that happened to be true. And I also liked working with brands and companies that were very early. I just think it's, for me, it's much more interesting getting into the early stages and building than it is managing 100 people.
Well, isn't that the case? I think that's something that all CMOs or marketers or anybody who has an entrepreneurial spirit, sometimes I think you think what you think your company should be or what your brand should be, and sometimes you get in the thick of it. You look around, you've got 65 or 75 employees,
right,
and you realize
you're not doing
I've completely lost
right.
my whole frame of
right.
reference.
You also have no idea what half of them are doing. But anyway, I was lucky enough to start with these companies when they were very small and had a role in building them to become much larger.
You talked about being part of a disruptive environment in the early days when disruptive was still people saying, well, what does that kind of mean? How do you feel like that's changed over really the last 5 or 6 years? Do you think it's become such a buzzword that it's hard to really have context to it? Or do you look at something like Away or even Airbnb as still being very disruptive in markets? And is the cycling getting faster?
Yeah, I think the cycling is faster. I think lots of industries are able to be disrupted. I think the term, unfortunately, is overused.
Everybody wants to be one.
Everybody wants to be a disruptor.
Who do you think is doing it well?
I do think the ride-sharing companies are doing it well. I think WeWork is doing it well. Yeah.
They just blew up, didn't they?
Yeah. So I think Airbnb is doing it well. I mean, the companies that I think are fascinating are the companies that, in effect, have no assets, but have these huge values and huge market caps because they've built, in effect, a better idea, a more disruptive idea.
Well, and so you use the word idea. And so that's the interesting thing as well in this disruptive space is it used to be that you had to have something extremely tangible and physical to mm-hmm. be disruptive. You used to have either tons of market capitalization or you had to be able to show these massive profits to some extent. But now you have these companies that are billion-dollar valuations on an idea who have almost no assets in some cases.
No assets, but consumer demand, revenue, and they've done a great job of communicating. And there was consumer use. Now, I mean, there is a difference between building a large company and building a profitable company. And the cannabis space is really emblematic of that. I mean, you've got the mismatch between some publicly held cannabis company market caps and what their sales are is extreme.
Yeah, and so that's a good transition and a fair transition. I promised that I'd make sure that we made
time
for
cannabis. That's okay. I did the transition for
you. Listen, we'd love to hear it. I was headed there. I promise you, Dean. That said, we're in the thick of it. So let's talk about it. To me, that next big disruptive space to some extent is the cannabis space because there's such a huge demand to the point of where we were headed. And at the same time, there's still a lot of unknown out in the space. You have these kind of different sides that are kind of pushing and pulling. You have this side maybe that's still ingrained in the belief that cannabis is a very lethal drug and that people don't know how to use it properly. But there's this whole endemic cycle in our culture right now of stress and mismanagement of that stress. And cannabis certainly seems to be not necessarily an elixir to that, but an opportunity to be able to try to actually take a healthy spin to some extent.
I agree. And I think that we've built and are building a medical cannabis company, which is different than what a lot of folks are doing. Yes, Tabrands. That's what a lot of people are working in the recreational end of the business. And I have no issue with that. But for us, we think we can do great good by being in the medical cannabis space.
And so talk about that next step then for you. You had the agency, you'd been to a few of these other places in the CMO seat. How did you end up deciding that the cannabis space was the next stop for you?
I mean, it really was happenstance. I mean, after years and years and years of physical inactivity, I started working out with a trainer. And this guy said, hey, I've invented this great product that's going to revolutionize the personal training business. And it's a protein supplement. Will you help me write my patent? So I helped the guy write his patent, and it became apparent that what he had was a delivery system rather than a way of delivering protein better to gyms. So we wrote this patent in a very broad fashion.
Had you ever written a patent before?
No. But, you know, I can read and write, and we had good legal advice, and it was granted on a provisional basis. And then we started discovering how we could best use it, and the cannabis space just leaped out at us, because here was this, especially the medical cannabis space, because here was this gigantic market, essentially with no brands. I mean, the medical cannabis space in the United States.
Still.
Yeah, it's roughly $7 billion category with no brands. And I just thought as a marketer, brander, I could build something really great here and do a lot of good. As you know, medical cannabis has been around for 10,000 plus years. People have used it in a variety of different cultures. And now, I mean, here's an interesting fact. There was a study done by the University of Michigan a couple months ago that asked people why they use medical cannabis. And in large part, they've tried prescribed pharmaceuticals. And for one reason or another, these prescribed pharmaceuticals have not worked. So they have switched to medical cannabis.
And so the delivery system that you initially patented, now that's you're using it in essence in
yes,
the cannabis space.
Let me just elaborate. So we developed an effervescent tablet delivery system.
Effervescent.
Yes. And don't think of it as Alka-Seltzer, because the effervescence is in the tablet to help disperse it in the liquid.
What does the word effervescent mean?
It means it fizzes and disperses.
Okay.
But we don't change the...
I should probably know that. Don't tell my English teacher from...
That's okay. We don't change the liquid to become fizzy. Interestingly, so let's take our... We have a Tab Relief product, and we're using as an active ingredient something called THCA, which is, in effect, raw cannabis. And it's non-psychotropic, which means that when you use it...
Does it require a prescription?
No. You can get a medical cannabis prescription, medical cannabis card, and this will allow you to buy it in certain states, and in certain states allow you to buy it at a discount. But it's still scheduled. I mean, it's still federally illegal, but it doesn't get you high. So the way it works is we have an unflavored variety, and the tablet is small. It's about the size of a Benadryl, so it's little. And you put it in any liquid, hot or cold. It dissolves instantly, and it takes on the flavor of that liquid.
And is the purpose of it, to some extent, is it a pain reliever? Is it a stress reducer? Or what's
people use it for a variety of reasons. Yeah. I mean, people use it for stress, to eliminate pain and inflammation, anxiety, sleep, appetite. I mean, there are any number of uses.
Well, it's a huge opportunity, obviously, in the space.
We think so.
And to your point, Dean, it's a chance to be able to kind of build some brand awareness in a space that is evolving extremely quickly, that's almost desperate for some brand identity to some extent.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think one of the other things that to me that's fascinating about the medical cannabis space is that, in effect, no one owns the narrative. First of all, there are a lot of interesting stories, a lot of interesting narratives. So I'll just give you one, for example. So we believe that our product can be an alternative to prescribed opioids. And... 92 million people in the United States have opioid prescriptions every year. And it's pretty clear that opioids cause issues, side effects, addiction. I mean, it costs the United States $1 trillion a year in caring for people with opioid problems. Well, in New York State, you know, where we are now, the state legislator said that doctors can now prescribe medical cannabis instead of opioids, which opens up a patient population in excess of 5 million people. Who really can benefit from this
stuff. Perhaps a lot safer.
Yeah.
We've got a couple minutes left. Dean Harris, are you CEO of Tab Brands? What's the title?
I am. I'm CEO and co-founder.
And how big is the company at this point? You guys
are
still in the early stage?
We're little. I mean, we're actually trying to build it to be small.
There's some value in that.
We think so. I mean, we have...
Certainly there's some peace of mind.
Well, our revenue model in large part is a licensing model. So it really doesn't take a lot of people to run that. It just takes product and it takes partnerships.
A license.
Yeah.
You talked a tiny bit as we wrap up. I want to talk about a family, since that's how we started the show. We'll put a button on it that way. You talked about your grandfather.
Yep.
Which was insane. That story is insane. I'm going to keep that as an interesting piece. You talked about your father. You're in the business and you said you have some kids.
I do. My kids are now fourth generation marketing.
That was my question.
Yes, they are, of course. They wouldn't want to admit it, but they are.
So talk about that for just a minute before we wrap.
One of them does data and strategy for the Children's Tumor Foundation. He lives in Brooklyn. And his wife also is in the marketing business. And then I have a daughter who lives in Stockholm. And she's in marketing. They don't call it that, but in effect, she's in marketing for PayPal.
Dean Harris, you have made this a family business, fourth generation. We'll see what happens next. CEO of Tab Brands, listen, we appreciate you being on the show today. If you want to find out more about Dean, you can obviously just Google Tab Brands. I'm sure you can go as at tabbrands.com.
Mm-hmm.
You can stalk him on LinkedIn. That's what I did. That's what I do with most of the guests that are on the show. Of course, just visit thecmosuite.com to find out more. Thank you again very much for Dean for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And take us out of the show.
Thanks for hanging out in the CMO Suite. For marketers who want to be in the know, presented by Connectivity Holdings.
You're a C-level manager. You shouldn't have to know the difference between behavioral or contextual targeting, but your agency should. UConnex provides brands and biddable teams direct access to platforms like The Trade Desk, Google, Amazon, Facebook, OTT, and more. Their U.S.-based traders can train your in-house team or provide complete transparency with no minimums and CPM-based service pricing for true transparency. Something Mighty Hive, The Trade Desk, and Centro simply don't offer. Tired of being the smartest one in the room? Reach out to UConnex today for a free demo. UConnex, the world's leader in true, transparent, biddable media.